Streaming May 23rd only on BET Plus. Miss Pat is back.
I'm excited.
And it's time for some grown-ass family time.
I am a man.
Oh, you a man?
That's right. Then take my clothes off. You ain't pay for none of that on your back.
Dad, you can't ignore your mother forever. I've tried.
Would you like me to backhand you again?
The Miss Pat Show. Streaming May 23rd on BET Plus. To sign up and learn more, visit BET.plus.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to The Three Questions. I'm your host, Andy Richter, and this week I'm talking to writer and comedian Greg Behrendt. He is the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, He's Just Not That Into You, and he worked as a consultant on Sex and the City, and he's been performing stand-up comedy since the early days of the 90s alternative comedy scene. His new book, which is a doozy, See You on the Way Down, Catch You on the Way Back Up, is available now on the Everan platform. We had a great conversation. This man has had quite the life. Here's my talk with Greg Behrendt.
Can't you tell my love's a girl?
Well, Greg, it's been a long time since we've seen each other.
Yeah.
And I just read your book, See You on the Way Down. It's a digital book, and it's on the Everand platform.
Yes.
And I read it, and wow, you have been through a lot.
You have been through a lot
since the last time I saw you.
Yeah. Well, my manager was taking a meeting with this particular book company, and they were talking about other people. And for some reason, they got on the topic of failure, and he said, oh, my God, if you want failure. This story
that
will
what a pal.
This story will blow your mind. Oh, yeah. Cancer twice, opiates twice. He had his hip replaced. He's just a disaster. He was once very famous and then not famous at all.
Yeah.
This is a great story for you. So So then he pitched it, and then I was like, yeah, I guess if you want, and I'll write about the last 10 or so years of my life.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was it.
Yeah. There was no sort of, was there like embarrassment that you had to get over? Or is it now just like you feel like you got nothing to be ashamed of and so let it all hang out?
I've always been pretty open about my life and my foibles and my failures and that kind of thing. So but that was when my girls were young and weren't paying any attention. Now they're in college.
Yeah.
And this stuff is embarrassing.
Yeah.
To a certain degree. And so I found it very hard.
Yeah.
You know, I had to run things by them and, you know, and I think ultimately they were supportive, but I remember I had a stand-up bit about my taking dog pills.
Yeah.
And it was like I got the
you
most.
You mean you had an elderly dog that was prescribed opiates, I guess.
Yeah, hydrocodone.
Yeah, pain pills. And then you started to take the dog's pain pills.
I started to take the dog's pain pills.
Yeah, yeah.
Much to the chagrin of the dog.
Yeah.
So I talked about that on this Comedy Central show, and one of my daughters wanted to have her last name, my last name, taken off of her. She was so embarrassed. She was I want to be emancipated.
Wow.
From him. Like, it was bad. Yeah, you know what I mean? And I always feel like those things are helpful because, like, you know, I get lots of people writing me saying, I saw that, I was on pills, blah, 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 that kind of thing. So it's a double-edged sword, you know? I mean, your kids want you to be a winner.
Yeah.
You know, to a certain degree, but that hasn't been my, that hasn't
been your trajectory.
That hasn't been my complete story.
Yeah. Well, were you able to kind of talk her down from that or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're fine with it now. We're great. The girls are both in college and we're great, but it was just an adjustment and, you know, they also had to live through it.
Yeah.
So it's not funny to them.
Yeah.
It's funny to say I took the dog's pills.
Right.
Right. But it's to live with a guy on dog pills, not as fun.
Yeah. Well, it's the kind of story that is completely dependent upon the telling. It could be like, I took my dog's pills, you know, and then it's like, oh, that's pathetic. Or, hey, I took my dog's pills, and it's funny, you know.
Right.
I mean,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So, but I mean, there's so much comedy that's like that. You know, it's pathos just told with a smart-ass attitude, basically.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And the way that I came up in comedy, you know, in the early 90s and here in L.A. in the, you know, un-cabaret.
Yeah.
Largo.
Kind of the alternative.
Yeah.
You know.
It was very much that kind of comedy. It was a lot of self-exploring and a lot of storytelling.
Yeah.
And a lot of, like, honesty.
Yeah.
Open honesty.
Yeah.
And so that's just how I do stand-up.
Yeah. And that was rewarded. You know, that kind of, like, the more sort of naked you can make yourself on stage, the better. It almost became, I think, in some ways, like there was a machismo to it. You know, like a kind of like, you know, who's gonna make themselves look worse?
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Kathy Griffin won. She came up with a story about somebody peeing on her, and you're like, wait a minute,
man, I quit.
What's my story?
You win.
I had a couple of drinks and I fell the fuck down. Who cares? Kathy wins.
Yeah. Well, now you're, let's start at the beginning. You're from San Francisco, you're from the Bay Area,
yeah,
and you grew up there, in relatively your folks. Worked in the TV business.
Yes, that's right.
In the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And it was a relatively normal house. Alcoholism, you know, which, I mean, is pretty normal in the suburbs, you know.
Yeah. I think in the book I said, you know, see Mad Men. Like, it was festive.
Yeah.
And everybody was doing it. So my parents didn't seem different than other parents.
Yeah.
But they were fun, smart, interesting people.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, it was a fine childhood.
Yeah.
You know, it was more often fun than not.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
People were hard drinkers back then.
People just drank hard.
You're just a few years older than me, And my parents, you know, they didn't have like beer parties. They were drinking Manhattans and stuff in high school, you know, and that just continued, you know. It was always, everything involved cocktails, you know.
I was 5 years old and I invited all the other neighborhood kids over to my house and I poured everybody a highball of water and expect them to sit down and have a conversation the way my parents would. And
sure.
Of course, everybody was baffled and nobody wanted to do it. But I wanted
supposed
to
light up their Pall Malls.
Exactly. And, you know. But I wanted to throw a cocktail party at five.
Yeah.
You know, I loved what that was like. My parents, we lived right by Kezar Stadium, which was the 49er stadium.
Uh-huh.
And my dad had season tickets for 41 years or whatever. But football was... It was big, but not big like it is now, where the stars are millions of miles away from you. After games, sometimes football players would come to our house.
Oh, really?
Just to drink, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I had like a second uncle or something that played for the Bears, Riley Mattson, and so there'd be people over. So it was a very exciting time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, where ball players are having drinks on a Sunday night at our house after the game, that kind of thing.
Because your dad was the manager of the TV station.
The NBC affiliate.
Yeah.
So you kind of
had a little touch with show business and with...
Absolutely.
Because sports, you know, is kind of show business, too. Yeah.
It is kind of show business.
Yeah.
It is kind of show business. And, so he was he had worked his way up from cameraman to station manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go down there. I even went down... I was a scab during a strike.
Oh, wow.
I went down to practice. I never actually worked, but I went down and drilled, and at 13 years old, I ran a camera.
For the news?
For the news.
Yeah,
You didn't have, all you had to do was hold the thing.
Sure, of course.
That was it.
Yeah.
You know, if I realized I was a scab, I wouldn't have done it, but my politics weren't in place then.
No, your politics are do what your parents tell you
to.
That
was and it was fun. We got up at like, we got to do it at 2 o'clock in the morning and it was, you know, it was all secretive and it was fun.
That's great. I mean, at some point you realize, you know, you have a facility for being funny and that people like to laugh at you. And are you going off to college? Or are you thinking I'm going to be a comedian?
No.
No?
No. I was deluded that I was somehow going to be playing sports of some kind.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What were your sports?
Football and rugby.
Okay.
And here's how bad I was at football. My senior year, I was the second string fullback. The first string fullback was having a shitty game. The coach gets us in the locker room, and this is what he says. The guy's name was Ken Flax, the other fullback. He goes, "We got a guy out here, number 44, Ken Flax, running like a goddamn pussy. And we got guys like Greg Barron here who work hard all week who will never see the field."
Thanks, coach.
Yeah. And of course, at first I yelled because I heard my name, and then I was like, oh, shit. And but I had success at rugby, and in high school we won the national championships, and then I went to Oregon, University of Oregon, and I was playing rugby there. And I had to switch positions from the position I was originally playing, and I broke my hand, and I didn't like the hitting anymore, and I'd gotten really deeply into music, and I just was like, no. And then a friend of mine said, you know, you need an arts credit, so I took an acting class, and that was it.
Okay.
That was it. When I decided. I didn't want to be a comedian. I wanted to be an actor.
Yeah.
You know, or something. I wanted to be in entertainment.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be in bands, and so I played in bands all through college. And was in the theater department and got my degree in theater and communications.
After you're done there, do you head right back down to L.A.?
I go to San Francisco.
Okay.
I live with my parents for like 6 months, and then I get enough money to move out. I'm trying to find work as an actor. It is not going well, and I don't have great
acting. There's not a lot in San Francisco, really.
Isn't. Yeah. There isn't. And I don't have great acting chops. Like, I just am, you know...
Did you have a suspicion of that at the time?
But
that's rough.
My mom, who was always looking for my mom, who had since I was a kid tried to get me to do comedy.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah,
yeah.
They were my parents. I was born in '63, which makes me. I think I'm like the last year of being a boomer. My parents were really into jazz and stand-up comedy.
Mm.
So they lived in San Francisco, so they went and saw, they saw everybody. They saw Lenny, they saw Phyllis Diller, they saw Newhart, they saw Cosby a number of times. Like, they really loved comedy.
Yeah.
And they had all the comedy records. So my mom was always sort of pushing for that, and I was like, Mom, I'm not going to prostitute myself for my comedy. That's just who I am as a person. I'm not a comedian. And then I got in an improv group. My mom saw an audition for an improv group. I got in this improv group, and lo and behold, who's in the improv group? Margaret Cho.
Oh, wow.
And Margaret had been doing stand-up for about a month. And after a week or two in the group, she's like, you have to do stand-up.
Yeah.
That's what you have to do. And so I put together a set, and I went to the Holy City Zoo, and I was on 35th. And the guy before me had a panic attack and ran off stage. And I went up, and I screamed about wrestling my grandma or something like that.
Yeah.
And it went well. And then I was like, oh, that was it.
Yeah.
I was done.
And how much longer do you stay in San Francisco? Or do you,
5 years.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I stayed 5 years. I worked myself up to being a feature act in San Francisco. And then sort of the advent of everybody moved to San Francisco at one point and was living there. Marin was living there. Mm-hmm. And
Dana Gould, I know, is
Gould
from
is from Gould is from there. Patton, Blaine, Posehn, Mitch Hedberg was living there at the time. Like, everybody was there. And then the Ben Stiller show happened. And we had become friends with Cross and Ruffalo and Benson and people from all around the world.
When they would go up there.
When they would come
sets,
up there. And they would come and stay with us. And we all partied like we'd won Emmys. and when they moved to do the Ben Stiller show, all of us said, let's go to L.A.
Yeah.
So we all moved down there around the same time.
Yeah, because there was a real thing happening here. I mean, it was about the same time that the Conan show was starting, and I would come out here, and I had a couple of friends that I sort of knew from that world, but I'd come out here, and it would just, there seemed to be a show every night, and you'd see... And all these people that you named, you know, I kind of would get to know them and, you know, from going to these shows and being a part of it. And it really did feel, for me and my taste, too, I was like, because stand-up never, the stand-up comedy that I knew, I didn't relate to it. You know, it was still kind of very 80s kind of feel, sort of more, you know, like jokes and observational humor.
Yep.
And not a lot of personal sort of stake in it. You know, it sort of, it seemed almost like an intellectual exercise with a transactional nature.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like you know, like Jerry Seinfeld is fucking hilarious. Jerry Seinfeld is a genius, but Jerry Seinfeld creates math problems with words.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like it's, and he does sort of touch on things that are sort of universal emotional feelings, but he doesn't get up there and you don't learn a lot about Jerry Seinfeld
deeply
about his psyche.
Not at all.
Whereas these stories and these people performing this way, it seemed much more, and to my, you know, young eyes at the time, young, artistic, you know?
I mean, it was just a direct reaction to the end of the comedy boom.
Yeah.
And we just couldn't get work either. So that's where all the alternative really comes from, alternative venues, because we were doing laundromats and right. restaurants and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But somebody pointed out to me the other day, when that group of comics came up there, somebody would go on stage and for 37 seconds talk without a laugh.
Yeah.
As opposed to boom, boom, boom,
right.
laugh, boom,
right,
boom,
right.
boom, laugh.
Yep.
And you'd be going, uh-oh. Whereas, you know, Cross was one of the greatest. Cross would be on stage for 3 minutes without letting you know what he was going to do.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
he would get a laugh. And so it was just different approaches to doing essentially the same, still comedy. We're still trying to, you're still trying to make people laugh.
Yeah.
You know, and all of us would have been happy to work in comedy clubs. They just weren't hiring.
Yeah.
You know, everybody wanted a career. It's just that this was what we were doing, where we were doing it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I you know, I came from improv in Chicago, which, you know, it's there's strict rules to it, but it's still about getting laughs. And I mean, and there's a lot of improv is very much meant to be popular. You know, like you're not, it's not meant to be that challenging.
Yeah.
There is, you know, there's a Del Close was one of, you know, was my probably main teacher. And he does likes to challenge people with like this referential, like, you know, making references to ancient Greeks and stuff like that, which I was never that into. But I still, like when I went to New York and started doing the Conan show, there was an alternative scene there kind of centered around the Luna Lounge.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my God, this is sophisticated New Yorkers. Like these people are, you know, they're doing stuff that it's going to be very artistic. I'm not going to. And then I went to see it and I was like, oh, it's just about being funny. Oh, they're just trying to get laughs. Oh, okay. You know, it's not that different. And it's like you say, you're still trying to get a laugh. You're just doing it in a way that, well, it's just a preference. It's just a preference of how you want to do your business on stage. You know?
Absolutely. And it also has swung back and forth. And look, at the same time, you know, during that, one of the biggest comics was Mitch Hedberg, who was nothing but a joke writer.
Yeah, yeah.
He was joke, 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 yeah. joke, joke. So, yeah. you know, I think it was also like alternative music at the same time. I think people just wanted something new. They were tired of what they had. They were tired of the cable shows. They were tired of seeing just the white guy, which was really pretty much all of stand-up. A lot of voices weren't represented. And they wanted something different.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted as we are always doing, we always want something different. We always want someone to show us something new, make us something new, you know, show us a world we haven't seen before.
Yeah.
You know, but the cool thing about that scene is that I think it blew comedy wide open. I think, you know, out of that you get an Arrested Development, not directly, not Mitch Hurwitz.
No, I understand.
But like, people are open to him trying that on network television.
Yeah.
You know, people are open to The Office. People are open to other, you know, ways of doing a three-camera sitcom or whatever.
Yeah, and I think there is, between the audience and the performers, they're teaching each other how to speak in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
Because it's like you said, David Cross gets on stage for 3 minutes, and the audience, who's used to a particular type of comedy, is there to see a different type of comedy. But they have to be taught, like, oh, no, this is, you know, they're taught a patience and they're taught a kind of, you know, a different way to kind of listen to things and look at things.
Streaming May 23rd only on BET Plus. Miss Pat is back.
I'm excited.
And it's time for some grown-ass Family time.
I am a man.
Oh, you a man?
That's right.
Then take my clothes off. You ain't pay for none of that on your back.
Dad, you can't ignore your mother forever. I've tried.
Would you like me to backhand you again?
The Miss Pat Show. Streaming May 23rd on BET Plus. To sign up and learn more, visit BET.plus.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
There was a club called Uncabaret that you were a part of.
Yeah, yeah.
And another person that was there at the time was Michael Patrick King.
Yes.
And you hit it off with him.
Yes.
And that changed the trajectory of your life.
Changed the trajectory of my life. So I did a set, and then Michael, who I didn't know, got up on stage and said, Greg is who I was pretending to be when I was pretending to be straight.
And it was, and because you basically wrote a love letter to a toaster.
Yes, that was it. I had a bit about a toaster that I was in love with. So then I came up to him and we said we should work on something together. And then I got a deal at HBO to do a Largo-like set about the toaster for HBO. And they asked Michael to direct it. And which was one of the best experiences of my life,
yeah. You know,
because I just had a bunch of jokes. I didn't have a one-man show.
Sure.
And we crafted this thing, and it went great. And then they liked Michael so much, they gave him the job at Sex and the City.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it was because of me, but it helped.
You
helps.
Might as well say it. Helped. He probably won't hear this.
Me. Yeah, he owes me.
Yeah. And so he starts that show. That thing takes off right from the beginning. Is huge right from the beginning.
Yeah.
And then tell everybody how you got involved with Sex and the City.
So Michael and I, there was this thing called Comedy World. Do you remember Comedy World? I don't think you probably even did. It was the very first internet streaming radio, all comedy radio network.
Okay.
So think podcasts.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just podcasts.
Yeah.
And they bought a big building in Marina Del Rey, and they put a bunch of different trailers in there, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they made them into studios. And so there'd be like six shows going at once.
Wow.
And I had my own show. Beth Lapidus had her own show, blah, blah, blah. And Michael was a guest on Beth's show, and we ran into each other, and he said, hey, I was thinking about you. Look, the staff of Sex and the City is 7 women and 2 gay men, and we could really use somebody to come over and tell us what pussy tastes like, because nobody here seems to know. The girls remember vaguely from college, but not enough to really.
You know, honestly, they each have one. You know what I mean?
Yeah, at some point, but
if work, I don't want to get into the spiritual, but it's like if work was wondering what an armpit tasted like, I think I might just go, well, hold on. I'll be right back.
So then I went there then I got asked to work, and the first day that was the question.
That was, you were just there as a pussy taste specialist.
That was what my job was to, and I was like, I don't know, it's like wine, I suppose. You know, it's all different, and every once in a while you take the cork out and you can't put it back in, and that's what you're stuck with. So that was it. But then I got into it.
There was an episode, right? Because it wasn't like somebody.
Samantha was having a girlfriend.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course she needs to discuss with her friends, her girlfriends. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was all about, there was a scene about having it on your face and all this stuff. I mean, they would, you know, they really tried to plummet the depths.
Right. That's the specialty of that show.
Yeah.
Going a little further than one would think.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And especially at the time, it was very, you know, like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, they were really out there. But
got you in the door there, and you were a consultant then.
Yeah, which was amazing, because at the end of the show, when they used to show credits, I had my own title card.
Yeah.
And that raise my profile around town, you know, like, oh, who's Greg Barron? What's Greg Barron doing there? You know, that kind of thing. And then, of course, you know,
that leads to
an innocent conversation with one of the writers on the last season who was seeing a guy, and she'd been out with him like 6 times, and she had invited him up the night before to have sex, and he said no, and she asked me if that was bad, and I said, well, it's not good.
Yeah.
And I said, he's just not that into you. And I don't even remember saying it, but the girl who's the co-author of the book, Liz DiCillo, heard it, and she grabbed onto it. And then we took it in the writer's room and we talked about it. And then we made an episode of that exact story.
Yeah.
And then it aired and they were talking about it on The View the next day. And that's when Liz came to me and said, I think we should write a book.
Yeah.
And I was like, a pamphlet, maybe, that you hand out at a bar. Like, I don't know that it's a whole book.
Right.
But she convinced me, and I told my wife about it, and she was like, yeah, you should do it. And so we wrote this for fun, you know, really silly, you know.
Yeah, intending it to be comedy.
We
thought
it was going to be in the humor section.
Yeah.
You know, like we thought, what's from the writers of, it's two people from the writing
it's
staff
from Sex
of Sex
and
the
City.
City.
It's not from Dr. Phil.
Right.
You know?
So it's, but the thing that's so crazy about it is when we turned in the manuscript to our agent, she split up with her fiance. And then when the book
from
went,
reading the story.
From reading the book.
Wow.
From reading the book, which is
now,
just.
Now, is that doesn't that like feel like, oh, I didn't mean you to do that.
I was just
fucking around. You
I
know?
Got a knot in my stomach. And then it went to the publishing house and two women broke up with their boyfriends.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was already having an effect before it was even published.
Yeah.
And Liz was like, this is going to be huge. And I was like, I hope it gets in Urban Outfitters. Like my my goals were lower.
An impulse buy, a point of purchase book.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. And then we got the call that we would be welcome guests on Oprah.
Wow.
And that was like, Oprah was at the height, you know, the week before I went on was the week she gave away all the cars.
Yeah.
So people were, she was at peak power.
Yeah, yeah.
And we went on the show. And I was on for an hour telling girls their boyfriends didn't like them. It was insane. It was insane. And Oprah was loving it. Yeah. God, she fucking loved it. He pat me on the knee and in the breaks, tell me how many books we were going to sell. And like came backstage to see me afterwards, which I was told she never does.
Yeah.
And like it was like a wild moment. You know what I mean? Like I had no concept of what was going to happen.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And at that point, I'd done stand-up for 15 years.
Yeah.
I'd shot 2 specials. I shot an HBO special and a Comedy Central special. And I wasn't famous, you know, but I was making my way.
Yeah.
And then that just, that one afternoon changed my entire life.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That, I mean, because I'm sitting here hearing this and I'm thinking, oh, but what about comedy, you know?
That because... was my, I remember going back to the hotel room and thinking, what have I just done to my comedy career?
Yeah.
You know? Because it wasn't like now where with all the social media, you can explain yourself and you can be five things.
Yeah, yeah.
You can be more things. But back then you were, you know, people's attention was either here or was here or was here, you know.
And the people that come to you because you've written this dating book will also then see you be funny too. Whereas in this, you go back on Oprah a number of times and they're not saying like, tell us your funny observations about modern life. They're like more dating shit.
Exactly.
Yeah. And exactly. Do you feel, because I just did a show recently and at the end, Mae Martin was a guest in it. And Mae asked me and Andy Daly about like when you were in college and you hit on girls. And I was like, it's hilarious that you think I have any idea how to hit on girls. Like, you know,
right.
Like the notion that like that there's that I have some sort of methodology to,
yes.
You know, whereas it was always just kind of like, I don't know, just, you know, like wait around till it's painfully obvious that this person likes me.
Yes.
Yeah. And so that I wouldn't if I like wrote some sort of lighthearted article about dating advice because it seems like fun and my friends encouraged me to do it. And then they say, well, you should do a book. And then I'd be like, I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. And I mean, did you have that feeling about dating or did you feel like you had some sort of perspective that that warranted all this attention and all this sort of seeking out your advice?
I thought, well, I'm a critical thinker, and I problem solve. Yeah. But I'd always say to someone before I talk to him, please understand, you're getting your advice now from a clown.
Yeah,
like you know, I was trying to write on television. You know, what I know about dating is just practical. It's just it to me, it doesn't even apply to dating. It applies to life in general. When somebody isn't showing up for you, you know, if they're not calling you back, you didn't get the audition. Like it's not happening.
Yeah.
But people think that you have more, like they believe you have more advice. And then I thought, maybe I do have more advice. I didn't really know.
Yeah.
You know, but it became, the money thing became so crazy because the book did so well. And then we sold the rights to a book for the movie.
For a movie. Yeah.
And we were also paid to write a script, which they didn't use, but it was fine. I didn't care, you know, and then there was a second book, and then there was this, there was all this stuff, you know. Yeah. And then eventually along came the talk show, which I turned down 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
But then I realized nobody else in show business was offering me work. Like I wasn't being offered comedy stuff.
Right.
And so I thought, well, I guess I'll do a daytime talk show.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe I can make that kind of cool, or maybe I can make that kind of funny, or I can, you know what I mean?
And that is, you know, so many people say, they'll say like, why did that person do that showbiz thing? And it's like, you don't get to necessarily, you know, very few people get to pick and choose exactly what path they get to take.
Exactly.
You know, you'd open a bakery and you know, you think you're going to sell bread, and all of a sudden, oh no, I guess it's brownies. Okay, here's, you know, we're a brownie bit. You know, you don't know.
You don't know, and you don't know what you can or can't do. Yeah. And
you think you can be funny in the middle of any of it.
Yes.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah. And I had, you know, I had young kids and there was all that.
Yeah, that, like, they'll make you fucking do anything.
Yeah. You know, yeah, you're like, Christ. Whatever.
Is there a check? Okay. Yes.
Yeah. There's so much school coming and all that kind of stuff. And I was taking care of my sister at the time. So I, you know, I was like, yeah, all right, we'll give this a shot, you know. But the thing is, as you know, like once you've had a talk show, there's not much more they can offer you.
Yeah.
They've given you the biggest piece of property you can own, which is an hour of your own.
With
your name on it every day.
Yeah.
There's no bigger thing than that, you know? And we did well enough to do it for a year, but it was canceled. And then it turns out that we had the same numbers as everybody got the next year. We could have stayed on, but we didn't. They didn't keep us on. And then I tried to go back to stand-up, which was very hard because most of the people that came out to see me had wanted to hear about the book.
Right.
You know, and I shot a special. I shot an hour that was on Comedy Central, but it didn't change. It wasn't bigger than the book. The book was just too big. It was too big that he's just not that into you. And so it sort of swallowed me up.
Yeah.
And then eventually I flipped out on stage and quit stand up for a while. I had a panic attack at a club in New York. And I was doing a set and this woman kept talking. There was a bachelor party.
Oh boy. Yeah.
And she kept talking and I was trying to get her to be quiet, and eventually I said, "Hey, do you like my books?" And she said, "I do." And I said, "Have you read my new book? Please shut the fuck up so I can do the rest of my set because it's doing really well."
Yeah.
And the crowd laughed a little, and then she got quiet for a minute. And then I was doing this big bit about magic, which is a very performative bit. And I go into the crowd and it's about how I hate magic. And I finish it and she just goes, "Boo." And I turned and I just went,
yeah, just let loose on her.
I let loose on her. I said she was the worst person I'd ever met. And I said she ruined the show for everybody. Everybody in the club should have burned their money in the parking lot. You're an awful human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate you. And then she started crying. And then she reached down and she pulled the book out and she held it up. And she was like, "You were supposed to talk about this. My boyfriend left me. I'm all alone. I'm by myself." And fortunately, a guy across the room goes, "Well, no wonder nobody will fuck you."
Boy. And then, oh, those stand-up crowds.
And then another guy goes, hey, I'll fuck her. Oh, and I said, thank you, good night. And I left, and I called my manager, and I said, I got to get off the road. I can't do this. Yeah. I don't want to fight with people about what I want to do. You know?
Yeah.
It was too much. And the movie was coming out, so there was tons of press about it, and it just wouldn't leave me alone. You know? As much as I'm grateful for it, I spent so long trying to create a stand-up career.
Yeah.
And, you know, all my peers, as we've already talked about, were all doing fantastically in comedy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's one of those things where if you were given the choice 10 times, you would have made the same choice 10 times.
Absolutely.
Because you can't go, well, this isn't exactly what I want to do. But it gets you lots of attention, and it pays for the family that you're starting. You know, you're like, you don't have a choice. And at a certain point, it's irresponsible to those kids that you decided to have to turn down something lucrative because it's beneath my artistic pretensions.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, no. And over time, I've made my peace with it and I'm grateful for it and even proud of it. And look, women would come up to me. I was in Chicago, and I was going to do early morning press with the club owner. And a woman ran across the street and said, hey, I read your book, and I was in this abusive relationship, and now I'm not, and I couldn't have done it without that. You saved my life. Thank you, you know, whatever. And she was crying, and, you know, I gave her a hug, and she went away. And the guy said, man, I've been with I know every comic that's ever been. No one's ever come up to a comic and said, you saved my life.
Yeah.
And then I said, I just wanted her to say I was funny.
Yeah. Well, you don't get to choose.
No. And so I am grateful that I put something in the universe that was ultimately helpful to people. You know what I mean?
That feels
good.
Yeah.
And I did something that, you know, it became a thing. It was a moment.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And a lot of people ever get to have that.
Yeah.
You know, and people work hard. And not people in the field of self-help don't get what I got.
Yeah.
You know, so I have gratitude.
Yeah, yeah.
Streaming May 23rd only on BET Plus. Miss Pat is back.
I'm excited.
And it's time for some grown-ass family time.
I am a man.
Oh, you a man?
That's right.
Then take my clothes off. You ain't pay for none of that on your back.
Dad, you can't ignore your mother forever.
I've tried.
Would you like me to backhand you again?
The Miss Pat Show. Streaming May 23rd on BET Plus. To sign up and learn more, visit BET.plus.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
I mean, your story, there's addiction in your story. And even, I mean, before all of this big stuff happened, before Sex and the City, for all of that, you were already a recovering alcoholic. You'd already been in recovery for alcoholism because you just found it was holding you back.
Yeah, it was too much, and I was starting to get sick, and I was living with Cross.
David Cross.
I was living with David Cross, and I would get up around 1 o'clock or two, and David had his own television show.
Yeah.
And I thought, there's a problem here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, David's actually a little younger than me, and he is working on his own show, and I'm just celebrating with everybody every night, but I'm not doing anything.
Right. Celebrating what?
Exactly. What am I celebrating?
Yeah.
So I went to a meeting. I looked in the phone book and I found AA and I called and I went to a meeting and I just put it down. And to be fair, I haven't had a drink since '96.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a job working in a catering truck, and you know, like And they would let me live a couple of months rent free.
Yeah.
I told my dad to stop giving me money because they were not helping.
Yeah.
And got my life together, you know?
Yeah.
And it was great.
Yeah.
It was really, really, really great. Yeah. Yeah. But 15 years into it, I was having that mental health problems and mm-hmm. I didn't know what was wrong. And so stupidly, I took the dog pills.
Yeah. Do you think that that was exacerbated by this sort of roller coaster ride?
Yes.
Yeah.
100%.
The mental health issues. You think that if you'd had more stable life that maybe you
yeah.
could. Yeah.
And my solution at that point was to start a ska band. And I say in the book, if your husband comes to you at 50 and says he's starting a ska band, just walk him straight to rehab. Just take him straight to rehab. There's no reason.
Because this is after you've already sort of slipped into the. Yeah. The pill addiction.
Yeah.
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 And now, could you get that many prescriptions for your dog, or did you have to sort of start?
Yes. The dog pills would come every month in the mail.
Wow.
And they were these giant jars. They were massive.
Wow.
I think this is before everybody got really hip to opiates.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But eventually it spun out of control, and I put myself in rehab, and then I was fine. And then 4 years later, I got cancer. I had non-Hodgkin's B-cell lymphoma, and what happened was I was on the road in Australia, and I'd had these stomach aches before I left, and I'd gone to the doctor, and they said, you've got some gas, it's like gas problem,
yeah.
You know, it's, you're fine.
Right.
I was like, okay, and then the pain got so bad that I couldn't walk, and I had somebody take me to the emergency room in Australia, and they put me out, and then they did an MRI or whatever and woke me up and said, you've got a cluster of tumors in your intestine.
Wow.
And
you were, this part of this story that is just kind of so fascinating and so like perfect to me is that you're in Australia doing a show that's based on you on a completely fabricated notion of you
yes.
being a Japanese, like an Anglo-Japanese star,
yes.
pop star. You have a blue mohawk.
Yep.
You had fake songs made up. You had fake products made up.
Yes.
You know, like
yes.
a pomade or something.
Yeah, pomade.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is like, you know, you weren't just down there telling stories about.
No.
You know, you were out on a limb.
I was swinging for the fences, man.
Yeah.
I was, the thing was, when you go to Australia, you go there and you do an hour.
Yeah.
And when you come back, you can't.
And it's part of a festival.
For a festival.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And when you come back, you can't do the same hour.
Yeah.
So I've been asked back the next year, and I'm like, I don't have an hour's worth of stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, but I do have this story that I think is pretty interesting, and I have these songs I think might be kind of fun, and I always wonder what it would be like to just pretend I'd been a pop star in Japan in the early 80s and had my own hair products and then get kicked out of the country by the emperor.
Yeah.
So it was really crazy.
Yeah.
And people would come up to me after the show and ask me about Japan where I've never been.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I'd say, no, this is all bullshit. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And we gotten a pretty good review. You know, I wasn't like selling out or anything, but
right.
We'd gotten a pretty good review.
But for a big swing, that's all you really, you know, just like the people are liking it, just not turning out and leaving before it's done. That's, you know, a victory.
Yeah, totally, totally, totally. And I loved all of it because I got to, you know, I had a pink plaid suit and I had two different flying Vs that I had painted, you know, fixed up and painted and, you know, I made all
so
this
stuff.
You get
to do the music too. And
the music.
Yeah, yeah.
It's everything. It's everything I like in
yeah.
1 hour,
yeah, yeah.
You know.
And you're sober at this time, right?
Sober.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally sober. And which is a testament to what can happen when you're sober.
Yeah.
And then I get the diagnosis and I said to the guy, he said, you've got tumors in your intestines. And I said, well, shit, I've had a pretty good life. And he goes, well, we're not picking out tombstones yet,
yeah,
mate.
Yeah.
But you got to fly home and get this taken care of.
Get back to L.A., yeah.
Yeah. But I was surprised at how I was 50 years old, and I was like, you know, I've accomplished a lot. I've done a lot. I'm okay. If I have to go now, I have two beautiful children. I have a loving wife who's going to take great care of them. They'll be fine without me. I did more in my career than I ever expected to. Wow. Yeah. You know, considering in high school they told me I wouldn't be able to get into college.
Yeah.
You know, like, I had a good life, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not afraid. If this is going to be it, this is going to be it. But fortunately, I got home and they said, this is a cancer you can beat and we'll give you 6 rounds of chemo. But the bad part of that was they cut me open to pull out my appendix so that it wouldn't jump onto my appendix. And then they sewed me back up, and then I immediately started chemo, which means that the wound wouldn't heal.
Doesn't heal, yeah.
Right. So they put me on OxyContin.
Yeah.
And I was on OxyContin for 6 months. And then they gave me 30 Norco to get off of it, and that didn't work. And I was in a club in St. Louis trying to get ready to do a show, and I was withdrawing. I was starting to get the shakes and feel sick. And so I asked somebody at the club, I asked one of the waiters, I'm like, if you can find anyone with an opiate, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they got me an opiate, and then I just couldn't get off them.
Yeah.
You know, for like a year.
That, I mean, it really is something. I mean, and I don't think the medical community has cracked opiate user, abuser in rehab, in recovery, gets cancer. How do you manage the pain? Like, what pain management does medical science offer to somebody that already has had an addiction to painkillers?
Right. And the strange thing is that you still feel the pain.
Yeah.
You just don't care.
Wow.
It's a very bizarre feeling.
That but sucks.
The pain doesn't go,
yeah. That really sucks.
The pain doesn't go away, but you feel magnificent.
Yeah. And, yeah. So it's like a pain distractor, not even a painkiller. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I should have been put through a proper detox.
Yeah.
You know, they should have detoxed me. And that's what they should do to everybody that they do that too.
Did you, I mean, at the time, did you just want to get back to work too?
Yes.
Do you think that was part of it? You're just, did you not, you didn't give yourself the opportunity to really, you know, have to get back on this beast and then wrestle yourself off of it. You kind of just wanted to get back. Was it like a denial? Like, kind of like, I just want to get back to life. You know?
Yes, very much, very much. And I also was afraid, you know, what's going to happen to my career? What am I doing? Well, you know, we need to make money. I need to work.
Yeah.
You know, I need to, stand up's the only thing I have. I got to get back out there. You know, it's been too long. And then, you know, then I started to get less and less work, and then COVID hit.
Yeah.
And then there was no work.
And were you still in the throes of addiction when COVID hit?
No, I was done.
You were done.
I was done.
Did you go back to another rehab? And
No, I did this, which I wouldn't advise. I detoxed at home on a drug called Suboxone, which is like a methadone for opiates.
Oh, wow.
And it was very hard. And I was erratic and difficult, and you know, my kids were afraid of me, and you know, it was a bad scene.
And I imagine that doesn't leave a lot of room for anything other than wrestling with that. Your days are pretty much taken up.
Yeah, pretty
probably
much.
Probably being erratic.
Yeah. Up and down, and you get the sweats, and you're still a little paranoid, and it's all awful.
Yeah. So when lockdown hits, I mean, what do you do? That I mean, well, were you scared? Were you like, oh shit, this is gonna, or were you happy to be sort of locked down like the rest of the world?
I had, so 8 months before lockdown, my oldest daughter said, "You have to live somewhere else."
Wow,
I can't get,
because you do. You're just so all over the map.
Yeah, she's like, I can't.
And how old is she at this time?
16.
16.
And she's like, I can't get through school.
Yeah, and 16-year-old daughters, they do not mince words.
No. So I moved out, and then I lived outside for 8 months. And then when COVID hit, they said, come back and live with us.
Yeah.
Were
they worried about you, do you think, that they didn't want you to be isolated that badly?
Yeah. And then I was clean at that point.
Yeah.
But then I got... Then I got prostate cancer.
Oh,
I know, it's such a drag.
Yeah.
I'm like, the next thing I do has to be really fun. But
can I get a fun cancer, please?
Something, man.
Yeah.
Can I get something? But anyway, that was really pretty simple. It was like, well, we'll just take your prostate out. Okay. I mean, it's not a simple procedure, but
But prostate cancer is one of the more overcomable ones these days. Yeah.
They, especially if they catch it early. But it can also be a nightmare if you don't get it.
Right.
So anyway, so then they just took out my prostate, and I moved back home. And and then
and no chemo. You didn't. Was there chemo, radiation, anything like that? Oh, okay.
Nothing.
Yeah.
They were like, let's not even fool with it. Let's just, you know. You know, and it's, you know, you like your prostate. You don't want to lose it, but.
Yeah, but living's a little better.
Yeah, but being alive is better.
Yeah. And you were able to kind of heal with the family?
Heal with the family, yeah. And then now both my girls went off to college.
Yeah.
And so now we're empty nesters, and I'm working, I'm doing and both. I'm working all over. I work in clubs still. I still work clubs, but I also started doing cruise ships.
Oh, wow.
Which was a total mind fuck because I was like, oh, cruise ship people are the worst. And, but I got this opportunity to work on this big, beautiful boat called the Allure of the Seas, which is a Royal Caribbean boat. Mm-hmm. And they have a comedy club and it seats 200 people. And you can do whatever you want. They don't care. It's just a comedy club.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't have to change your act. I mean, it's okay if you have a few jokes about the boat and they like
that.
Sure,
sure.
But I could just work.
Yeah.
And it was more money than I was making in the clubs, and I don't have to sell tickets. They're not banking on you.
Right, right.
You know, and so everybody shows up, and then they have a theater that seats about 2,000. So then you do the last show of the night is in the theater, and it's all adult comedy, and I was like, well, this isn't bad, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not bad.
It's kind of fantastic. It's kind of... Because I know for a lot of people, and myself included, you do this, there's all kinds of exciting things that happen, but then it just gets to be like, I just want to do the thing. I just want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't need a lot of bells and whistles, and I don't need a lot of, you know, somebody slapping me on the back or putting awards in my hand. I just want to do the thing. And you're getting to kind of do that in a way where, and also nobody's fucking with you. That's the other thing. You don't want somebody to be like micromanaging the thing that you're trying to do.
Right.
You know?
Right. And, you know, I just want to earn a living. Like I don't, doing the thing that I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
That doesn't mean I don't have other plans or schemes or things that I want to do. But I very much enjoy just working. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I enjoy, you know, going out, going on ships, seeing the world, and you know, there's a gym in there and I can work out for a couple hours and
like, how long are you gone for a time?
I usually go out for about a month.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I'll do two ships back to back, something like that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, but then I'm home for a couple of weeks,
you know,
and so it's good, and my wife writes, and so she likes it quiet in the house, so, you know.
Well, and I imagine you guys have been through a lot, and the fact that you're still together is a real testament to the bond. I mean, I imagine, you know.
Yeah, she's the greatest. She is the greatest, and she's put up with a lot, and I'm trying to make the last half of her life decent.
Yeah. So I imagine you're pretty grateful to, you know.
Super grateful.
Yeah.
Super grateful.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what I want to do, my goal now is to, I thought about maybe I'll do an oral history of the alternative comedy scene, you know, because I write and because I know everybody.
You know all those people, yeah.
And we just did a show like a month ago at the El Rey.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, the Mr. Show people and Zach and Sarah and Marilyn Rice Cub and Possein and Benson and Gould and me and it was sold out and people loved it.
Wow.
I thought, well, there still is an interest in this. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to take the time to interview.
Was everybody just doing sets or did they, or was it sort of like reminiscence kind of?
No.
Oh, sets. Wow. It was just
just comedy.
That's great.
Yeah. Just comedy. And it was supposed to be reminiscent of a show that we used to do called Tantrum at the Diamond Club. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to spend the time and talk to these people, I might as well, maybe I'll just put it on film.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll make a documentary about it, you know, because I think it's an interesting part time in comedy.
Yeah.
You know, it definitely was a scene.
Yeah.
I
and there's interest in it. I mean, I've heard other people talking about that particular, I think there might've been an LA Times article about on Cabaret, maybe.
Yes. Yeah. I think people would be interested in it enough. I mean, there's enough there's all kinds of books about, I mean, I love reading as told to books by punk scenes all over the world.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that stuff. I love rock biographies. And I think, God, it would be really fun to, and everybody, gratefully, thankfully, is still alive and working and, you know, doing good stuff.
Yeah. So that, yeah, that's, I mean, you've got, you know, you, are there other things like that you have in mind that you want to try and do, or is that kind of right before you? In the
that's kind of what I'm focused on.
Yeah,
is doing that. I'd like to do another hour, do another special at some point.
Yeah,
you know, I have the one cool thing about the ship is you can write material all the time. So you know, I have a whole. I'm coming up on having a whole another hour, and I'd like to do that.
Yeah,
who knows where, wherever.
Right.
You
know.
However.
You know. We've been talking an hour, and well, that's a lot. There's a lot going on in that life. And I wonder, like, if there's, like, if you have a point to it all, you know, like, if you've come up with some idea what the point of it all is, or what, you know, what's the thing that you take away from your own story? Like, what's the moral of your own story?
Well, I mean, I could have died a number of times in a variety of ways.
Yeah.
But I didn't.
But you're not even good at that.
I can't even really get that to work.
Can't even fucking die right, dude.
I mean, two cancers. Come on, man. What are you fucking thinking? Addicted to opiates. You know how many people are just snorting fentanyl and dropping off the... You didn't snort fentanyl? Ugh. Like Amira said, if you had been a kid now, you wouldn't have made it past 15.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, that's
probably right.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
But I think the two things... One thing I stress in the book is that a lot of my success is because I've sought professional help.
Yeah.
I believe in psychiatrists and I believe in therapists and I believe in medication.
Yeah.
You know, it's really helped me. I've seen it help other people. I really think if you're really feeling lost and alone, like just reach out.
Yeah.
There's people who are chomping at the bit to help.
I don't understand why there's shame in it.
It's crazy.
No, but I mean, but it exists, you know, it's
of course,
you know, I mean, I, part of why I do this podcast is because I've been in therapy a million years and I like to talk in those ways. It's a kind of its own language.
Yeah, of course.
And I like to talk to people who understand that language. And I have talked about it in public forums in different ways. And I'm not one to go like, I share my struggle so others can learn. You know, that always feels so like masturbatory when a lot of people say that. But I've talked about, I've had depression. I've had struggles with mental health. No shame in seeking out help for it or being honest about it or being unashamed of it. And I've had so many people say how meaningful that was.
Yes.
And I mean, you know... And that's pretty undeniable. It's pretty undeniable that to just simply say that thing and have that mean something to people, you know. And I'm, you know, like I always remember a guy in the Warner Brothers commissary. I was there and getting coffee before going to the gym and working out. And this guy came up to me and said, he had like a kind of a Southern accent. And he said, like, I've been struggling with stuff for years. And I just was always, I felt like my parents wouldn't approve. And just hearing you talk, and it was on another podcast, hearing you talk about it made me go and get help. And I just want to thank you because it's made all the difference in the world, and I may not have done it otherwise, which is wonderful to hear. But also I'm like, Jesus Christ, really me? That I did that? You know? So it does matter to say it, you know?
It does. I you know, because I was renowned for helping people.
Advice guy. Yeah.
I thought, well, I don't need help.
Yeah.
I mean, for a while, I mean, otherwise I wouldn't have taken dog pills.
Yeah.
You know, I was making my own decisions because I thought, well, I don't need to talk to anybody. I'm a problem solver. I'll solve my own problems.
Sure.
Which was the biggest mistake ever, you know? And, you know, I know that like when I first got sober from alcohol and stuff, I probably wouldn't have done it if the guys in Aerosmith hadn't done it. Tried to do it. I don't know how they're doing today.
Right, sure, yeah.
But they're
still around. So that's still, something. Yeah.
But that was like, because I loved them and I thought, well, shit, these guys were really fucked up. I mean, if they could do it, maybe I could do it.
Yeah, you
know? Yeah.
Well, that's a good message to give. And the book, I mean, the book ultimately is kind of a hopeful story. See you on the way down on the Everand platform. it's a you know, it's a fun read, but it's harrowing because you know you like I say, you know, you have, it's been a roller coaster ride.
Yeah, definitely, definitely, and it does feel like I've come through a lot, and there's a lot of good to come. You know what I mean? Like, I am excited about the future.
Good.
You know.
Well, Greg Behrendt, thank you so much. Folks, look for him doing stand-up near you. Is there a website where people can get yourself?
If you just go to my Instagram, that's all you'll need. And my Instagram is itsgregors.
It's Gregors.
It's Gregors.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Greg.
Thank you, buddy.
And thank all of you out there for listening. And I'll be back next week with more of The Three Questions. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco production. It is produced by Sean Daugherty and engineered by Rich Garcia. Additional engineering support by Eduardo Perez and Joanna Samuel. Executive produced by Nick Liao, Adam Sachs, and Jeff Ross. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, with assistance from Maddie Ogden. Research by Alyssa Grawl. Don't forget to rate and review and subscribe to The Three Questions with Andy Richter wherever you get your podcasts. And do you have a favorite question you always like to ask people? Let us know in the review section.
Can't you tell my love's growing? Can't you feel it ain't showing? Oh, you must be a knowing. I've got a big, big love.
This has been a Team Coco production.
Streaming May 23rd, only on BET Plus. Miss Pat is back.
I'm excited.
And it's time for some grown-ass family time.
I am a man.
Oh, you a man?
That's right.
Then take my clothes off. You ain't pay for none of that on your back.
Dad, you can't ignore your mother forever.
I've tried.
Would you like me to backhand you again?
The Miss Pat Show. Streaming May 23rd on BET Plus. To sign up and learn more, visit BET.plus.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.